Dr. Stone is not only the director of JPL, but also a vice president and David Moriaros Professor of Physics at the California Institute of Technology in, obviously, California. He is chairman of the board of directors of the California Association for Research in Astronomy, which is responsible for major telescopes in Hawaii, and he's also a director of the Keck Foundation. Since 1961, Dr. Stone has been principal investigator on 9 NASA spacecraft and co-investigator on 5 other NASA missions. He has served as project scientist for the Voyager mission since 1972 and actually worked on both hardware development and mission operations. And after the launch of the program of the spacecraft in 1977, he coordinated the efforts of over 11 team scientists in their studies of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. Dr. Stone has received the National Medal of Science, the American Philosophical Society Magellanic Award, and several other major awards. He has also received the NASA Medal for Exceptional Scientific Achievement and the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics Dryden Medal. And interestingly, in 1996, I gather, an asteroid was named after him. He is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, the International Academy of Astronautics, and several other distinguished international scientific bodies. Today he is going to speak to us about the latest findings from the Galileo mission to Jupiter. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Ed Stone.
Thank you. I'm certainly very pleased to be here today. I've been over the last several days visiting the Tibbenvilla station and planning to be out to Parks tomorrow, so this afternoon is a wonderful opportunity to talk a little bit about the Galileo mission. The space era of planetary exploration began 33 years ago when Mariner 2 flew by Venus in 1962. There have been a number of missions since then, and they've revealed dozens, literally dozens of diverse worlds which share the solar system with Earth, worlds which beckon our return for a much closer look than our earlier missions could give us. Galileo is such a mission because it will give us a much closer look at Jupiter and its moons, which really are worlds in their own right. Now, a journey to the... Do we have a projector on? I just punched the button. There we go. Ah, thank you. A journey to the outer solar system is really a journey to planets rather different than what we're used to. This is a graphic showing to scale by size the planets in the solar system: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. They're not scaled in distance, though, according to scale. Jupiter, for instance, is 5 times as far from the Sun as the Earth. I believe it was Isaac Asimov who tells a little story like this, that he said, if you were to ask an alien intelligent being to describe the solar system, the description might go a little something like this. There's a star, our Sun. There are 4 planets. And there's debris. This really further makes the point. This is an image of Earth and Jupiter to the same scale. These are giant planets in the outer solar system. We believe buried deep inside of Jupiter there's a core of material which was accumulated as rock and ice, comets if you like, but which melted. The temperature there today is, even today, 4.5 billion years later, is still 10,000 degrees or so. The bulk of the planet, though, is made of gas and liquid. No solid surface anywhere in this giant planet. Voyager flew by in 1979. Pioneer had been there earlier. But those were brief flybys. What we needed to do was go back and do 2 things. First of all, directly sample that atmosphere, go down into it for the first time, and then to put a spacecraft in orbit so we could stay for a while and more closely observe the diversity of that system. So some years ago, in fact, 1978, the plans for the Galileo mission began. It was supposed to have been launched in the early 80s. This is the spacecraft. You can see the technicians, engineers and technicians down here at the base of the spacecraft. The central portion are the fuel tanks to carry along the fuel needed in order to put the brakes on, because if we didn't fire a rocket when we got close to Jupiter, we would fly right on by. We have to slow down to go into orbit. You can see up here an umbrella, folded up umbrella-like structure. That's the high-gain antenna, which was supposed to have opened into a dish antenna about the size of this black blanket you can see here. And I'll come back to that in a moment. That was to be our primary communication link, both up to the spacecraft and, more importantly, even to return all the data back from the spacecraft. Now, tucked up underneath here, which can't be seen in this image, was a probe, which was designed to be dropped into Jupiter's atmosphere. It's instrumented to measure wind, the temperature, pressure, the kinds of molecules which make up the atmosphere, to look for lightning, cloud decks, and so on. And that, I'll be describing some of the early results from that very important experiment. The Galileo was launched by the shuttle. This is an artist's sketch. Here's the Galileo spacecraft, and this was the upper stage, which had to be carried up with the spacecraft in the bay of the shuttle, because the shuttle can only bring us into low Earth orbit. We have to then fire this large rocket to put us on our way to Jupiter. Back in 1986, Galileo was in Florida, ready to be launched. It had attached to it a different rocket, a much more powerful rocket, which contained liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, a very explosive mixture. Unfortunately, in January of 1986, four months before we were to launch Galileo, the Challenger shuttle blew up, losing the lives of the astronauts and putting the shuttle program on hold for the next 3 years. It became immediately obvious that we were not going to carry a rocket filled with explosive liquid hydrogen in the shuttle. We had to then resort to a much smaller rocket, and it wasn't immediately clear there was any way to get from Earth to Jupiter in 1986, because the spacecraft, which was already built and ready to go, was too massive to be launched directly with this smaller rocket. Fortunately, the interplanetary navigators came up with a counterintuitive idea. That is, you launch from Earth, and it turns out we launched finally in 1989, but you don't launch out toward Jupiter. You launch in toward Venus, toward the Sun. You fly by Venus, and Venus, with its gravity, gives a slingshot boost to the spacecraft velocity, which then has a larger orbit, as you can see, to time just such that it comes back for its first encounter with Earth in December of 1990. Earth gives it another slingshot effect, makes its orbit still larger, coming out to our first encounter ever with an asteroid, Gaspra, in October 91, back to one final slingshot past the Earth in December of 92, finally enough velocity to make it all the way to Jupiter. Here we flew by Ida, another asteroid, which I'll mention briefly. And then in July of 1994, Jupiter was here, we were there. When Shoemaker-Levy comet pummeled Jupiter, we were the Galileo spacecraft was the only observatory which could see the actual impact on the backside of Jupiter. Then a year later, the probe was released in July of 1995, and on December 7th, the probe entered for the first time into the atmosphere of Jupiter. So it was a long way to go. Instead of flying directly from Earth to Jupiter in 2 years, less than 2 years, we had to take from 1989 to 1995 to get there, but we are now there and have some first results and a mission coming up, which is going to be very exciting. One of the problems we had that because we were going into the Sun, we could not open the high-gain antenna. We couldn't open up that umbrella right away because it was not designed to take the sunlight in here. There's twice as much sunlight at Venus as at Earth, so we had to leave this umbrella furled up until we passed the Earth the first time, and the orbit would then always keep us outside of Earth's orbit. So about here, we tried to open the high-gain antenna, and it would not open. It would not open. This is what we think the antenna looks like. You can see the ribs of the umbrella. You can see the fine mesh, which is a metallic mesh, which was to form the shape, the high-gain parabolic shape to transmit data back to Earth. And three of the 18 ribs did not disconnect from the tower as they should have in when we tried it in 1991. And suddenly, the rate at which we could send data back to Earth was decreased by almost a factor of 10,000. 10,000. That's a very hard factor to overcome. Several things were done. We have will reprogram the space computer on the spacecraft to compress and reduce the number of bits that we have to send back for every image that we have. And in addition, we upgraded the receiver capability here on Earth to make it more sensitive. This is the 70-meter antenna, which is out just outside of Canberra in Tidbinbilla, and a 34-meter antenna. Currently, a second 34-meter antenna is being constructed, and for 12 hours a day, every day, this is the prime site for returning data from Galileo, because we will combine this antenna, the signal from that antenna, the signal from the other antenna, and the signal from the CSIRO 64-meter dish antenna in Parkes will all be electronically connected together, so they act as though they're a single, much larger antenna. This will be the most sensitive antenna system in the world for receiving data from Galileo, and we will be using it essentially this part of it 10 hours every day, beginning in November of this year and continuing for over a year. Now, this would not have been possible if the work had not been done here in Australia to make this antenna useful for Galileo. And that's what tomorrow's event is all about, is the dedication, recommissioning of the cabin which up here, which has in it a new receiver designed by CSIRO specifically to listen to Galileo, and a special mechanism which allows that receiver to be switched into place within minutes, then switch back out after the run is over, so radio astronomy can continue to be done during the same year that the antenna is listening to Galileo 10 hours a day. It's a critical contribution to recovering from a very serious problem that we have with the Galileo spacecraft. This is asteroid Ida. This is the second asteroid that we flew by. To give you a sense of scale, it's about 56 kilometers from here to here. But the most surprising thing about Ida is that. That's a little moon. An asteroid, which is only 50-some kilometers across, has its own moon called Dactyl. A little moon about 1.4 kilometers across. It even has impact craters. That impact crater right there is about 300 meters across. Now, this little moon orbits this asteroid, and that means because we know how rapidly it's orbiting, we can measure the mass of Ida for the first time. We know how big it is, and we can therefore determine its density. If Ida had been a piece of stony iron material like some meteorites, that's material which had been melted and condensed and has a density about five times that of water, that's the density we would have found. We found a density half of that, suggesting that the asteroid itself is porous. That is, it's 25 to 50% empty, meaning that it has never been melted and consolidated and recrystallized, that Ida is a very primitive object, perhaps very much in the very state it was in when it was first formed 4.5 billion years ago. And those are the kinds of objects which hold very important clues to the kinds of materials out of which everything in the solar system was eventually made. And that's the kind of asteroid we hope someday to be able to explore more closely, not just fly by, but actually rendezvous, get down onto its surface, and eventually bring something back. Another very exciting accidental opportunity we had on the way to Jupiter came in July of 1994 when Shoemaker-Levy, this comet which broke up into 20-some fragments, was on a impact trajectory with Jupiter. And for about a week, many people around the world watched day after day as pieces of Shoemaker-Levy on the order of a half kilometer or so in size pummeled into Jupiter, each of them leaving behind these dark blotches. Let me again remind you of the size of the system. This brown blotch, which is a blotch of material, a deposit of material in the atmosphere, is about the size of the Earth. So these were major cataclysms which occurred one after the other over a period of a week. All of them occurred behind Jupiter, right over here, so that from Earth one could not see the impact. We could only see the erupting plume as it became large enough to be seen over the edge of the planet, because the temperature was hot enough that this huge plume of material became visible, both the reflected light and also in the heat, because it became something like 7,500 Kelvin, 7,500 degrees, because of this impact. But Galileo was in a position and did capture some of the plumes. Here's one example. These are a set of pictures of Jupiter taken by Galileo from some fair distance. There is a 2 1/3 seconds between each of these images. So 2 1/3 seconds later, you can begin to see a bright flash, the peak of the flash, and then fading away. We believe that this flash is the explosion of this object as it burrowed into the top of Jupiter's atmosphere, and that explosion then generated this huge plume of material which could be seen from Earth and which glowed at a temperature hotter than the surface of the Sun. But 1 year later, July of 95, we were now ready to get ready for Jupiter. We released the probe on July 13th of last year on its way to an impact with about in this region right here in the atmosphere of Jupiter. You can see all these clouds. We'll come back in a few minutes and talk about the wind velocities associated with these clouds. The probe was designed to measure the winds not just at the cloud level where we can see them, but below the cloud level, and to measure the material out of which this giant planet is composed. To give you an idea of what where the probe entered, this is an image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope just several months before the probe actually entered, but well after we launched the probe from the spacecraft. And this is roughly where the probe entered. And you can see it's a dark region in the clouds. What that means is that the probe, by accident, because there was no way to target the probe with this kind of precision in terms of where it would occur in this latitude band, but just by accident, it entered into a region of the atmosphere which was clear of clouds. And the reason this is dark is because there are no clouds to reflect the sunlight back, and the sunlight just disappears deep in the atmosphere. In this image, which is taken in infrared light, that is heat, you can see that where there's a gap in the clouds, a lot of heat pours out from deep inside the planet, because the interior of the planet is much warmer than the clouds we're looking at. So it turns out that the probe entered into the atmosphere in a region which was relatively free of clouds. This is the this was the probe mission. Probe entry started here. A parachute was deployed. There's a nose cone to essentially take a lot of the energy out, but just by burning away the nose cone. From here to here, where the nose cone is ejected and the parachute is fully deployed, is 2 minutes. In 2 minutes, the probe goes from a velocity of 170,000 kilometers per hour to less than 200 kilometers per hour. 2 minutes. The maximum deceleration, which the probe suffers right about in here, is 230 times the acceleration of gravity. This is the most severe entry that has ever been accomplished. Re-entering the Earth's atmosphere is trivial compared to entering into Jupiter's atmosphere, because Jupiter is so massive and has such an immense gravitational field to speed the probe up to this very high velocity. Then, of course, slowly over the next 57 minutes, parachutes down through about 200 kilometers of atmosphere below all the known clouds, down to where we believe that we should have a very good sample of what the interior of Jupiter is like. If I could now have the video. In fact, here we come. This is a simulation of this sequence which I just showed you. As it took place on the 7th of December, we collected almost 58 minutes of data. The data is relayed back to the spacecraft and stored in the spacecraft computer memory and redundantly on the tape recorder. So we were sure that this data, which could only had to capture one, that we did not lose it. Here you can see the antenna problem, which I mentioned earlier. The spacecraft is spinning to provide stability to the probe because we're about to launch the probe. This is July 13th last year. You'll see the probe just pushed off gently from the spacecraft. As the probe was launched on its way, the only thing running on the probe was a clock. We had no further communication with the probe until December 7th. We had to assume that the clock on the probe would turn it on and start its instruments running and start its transmitter transmitting at the right time. We had no way to send it any commands or anything. It was launched and that was it. Now, the spacecraft would have followed the probe into Jupiter's atmosphere unless we corrected its trajectory so that within a few days we fired the main engine of the spacecraft to move it off of its impact course so it would not follow the probe into Jupiter. Move it just far enough away from Jupiter so that it was above the probe and could receive the data from the probe. The probe entered into this region in the atmosphere right here, one of these open spots in the cloud deck. And there, that small white spot is supposed to indicate roughly where it went in. The simulation in a minute will show you, will try to characterize the amount of heat. The temperature on the nose of the shield was twice that of the sun as it was slowing down from 170,000 kilometers per hour down to a few hundred kilometers per hour. Here's the chute being deployed. First the small chute, followed by the main chute right here. Then that will slow the probe down, and the heat shield will then be lost, just let go to fall down into the atmosphere separately. The data now begins at a temperature of about minus 150 centigrade Celsius. And as it drops down to the atmosphere, it's measuring the temperature of the gas. We were measuring the amount of light and heat flowing up out of the atmosphere as the probe rotated at 30 times a minute, looking in all directions. And as we went down in the clouds, it became darker, and by the end of the 200-kilometer mission, essentially we had gotten down to where it was quite dark. We had both a optical detector to look for lightning flashes, as well as a radio receiver to listen for static. We did find lightning flashes, but none very near where the probe went in, because lightning is associated with clouds, and so the lightning came from some distance away. Well, that just gives you some idea of what we have already learned and some of the things which we'll be learning as we fly by Io and Europa and look at Jupiter over a period of years rather than for a very brief snapshot as Voyager had back in 1979 as it flew by. And during the next two-year period, Galileo, just as Voyager, will rewrite the textbooks on the solar system. And during the next 2 years, the stations here in Australia are the primary way that we are both going to tell the spacecraft what to do and the primary way that we're going to get the information back from the spacecraft. So I hope you'll all be looking forward to it. I know I am. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure we'd all like to express our thanks to Dr. Stone for such an interesting lecture. It's really amazing to find out how much we can learn about a planet which is so far away from us. And I think the complexity of the Galileo mission is one that almost boggles the mind when you think about how much could go wrong, how much did go wrong, and how NASA managed to fix it and still get really good science back. And will continue, we hope, to get really good science back.